From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, you know, we were 14 years ahead of science, and Neil Slay talks with us about his brain work on Coast to Coast AM. Here's what's happening. Well, does it get any worse in Japan, and maybe for the rest of us? Japan has suspended operations to prevent the stricken nuclear plant from melting down after a surge in radiation made it way too dangerous for workers to remain at the facility. The chief cabinet secretary in Japan said work on dousing reactors with water was disrupted by the need to withdraw and get people out of there. The level of radiation at the plant has surged. The nuclear crisis has triggered international alarm and partly overshadowed the human tragedy caused by Friday's double disaster, which pulverized Japan's northeastern coastline, killing an estimated 10,000 people. Linda Moulton Howe, our investigative reporter in EarthFiles.com, has been looking at this story and just got off the phone with an expert about the possibility of nuclear contamination and radiation. Linda, what have you found out?
Yeah, George, it started at about 8:30 p.m. Pacific time tonight. I was talking with Scott Portzline of Three Mile Island Alert in Pennsylvania about why the firefighters and the workers would have been withdrawn from the unit number 4 that was on fire yet again. And Scott was going on to NHK World TV News and found a frame that showed a series of holes or frames that showed a hole in the size of Unit 4. And he said, I think they have withdrawn the firefighters because the spent fuel pool number 4 attempt to refill it with water indicates to me that the radioactive levels are so high because that fuel is in fact uncovered, meaning that those pools were drying out. And with the fuel unshielded, that means that cesium-137 mm-hmm. will be coming out, and that at the levels that were reported, they were reported finally at as high as 1,000 millisieverts, and that would cause radiation sickness to those people there. Well, as Scott and I talked about it, he said, look, I want you to talk with Arnie Gunderson. He is the nuclear engineer and safety expert with Fair Winds Association. He's been on BBC and various TV.
Yeah, he's been all over the place, yeah.
And so Mr. Gunderson called me tonight, and he was looking at this video for that Scott had and said, this is a quote to me tonight. I think the Unit 4 firefighters were withdrawn because the fuel pools are drying out. That means high levels of cesium-137 at the site, and the uranium products will turn into radioactive gases that can touch skin and be breathed in. This is as bad as or worse than Chernobyl, close quote. And George, tomorrow, in another 24 hours, Scott and Mr. Gunderson both said we should know the worst. And he and I hopefully will talk again tomorrow. So depending upon what happens in this unfolding, unbelievably awful situation, I might have more to report tomorrow night depending upon what happens.
Okay, Linda, let's stay in touch with each other. 500 bone marrow transplant centers across Europe are now being asked to be on standby to treat Japanese radiation victims if the need arises. The European Group for Blood and Marrow Transplantation has been alerting its members, which include 3,000 medics and specialist units. It is unclear how many in Japan might need their help, but the centers have plans and protocols ready to go if need be. And with the world's eyes fixed on Japan and its government's attempts to contain the threat of nuclear meltdown, Americans on the West Coast are wondering if oceanic winds have the potential to blow in radiated fallout off the Pacific Ocean. Now, despite numerous health officials' assurances that Americans here are all not at risk, drug suppliers report increased demand for the anti-radiation potassium iodide pills, which prevent against radiation poisoning of the thyroid gland. Potassium iodide pills are reportedly flying off the shelves at drugstores in at least three West Coast states, Oregon, California, and Hawaii. According to several local press accounts, expect the demand to continue growing as the nation's leading public health officials are recommending residents of San Francisco's Bay Area to stock up on the little tablets as a precaution. As a matter of fact, U.S. Surgeon General Regina Benjamin has voiced her support for this precautionary measure, saying that people should stock up on these pills. How ironic, because back in 2008, the government said no need to stock up on any of these pills, no need at all. They're unnecessary. You don't know who to believe. And tsunamis on the scale that hit northeast Japan last week may strike the region about once every 1,000 years, according to a seismologist, Dr. Roger Musson. He said there were similarities between last week's event and another giant wave that hit the coast in 869 A.D. You know, back several weeks ago, we were talking about the possibility of May 21st this year being Judgment Day. That's when many would be taken and many would be left behind. Chris McCann, spokesperson for Internet Ministry and works in conjunction with Family Radio, he's back on the line with us here. So, Chris, let's clarify again. Judgment Day is supposed to be May 21st of this year, where a number of people will be taken. They'll be just gone, and the rest of the people on the planet will have this torment. Am I reading that right?
Yeah. Hi, George. Hi. Thanks for having me back on. Yes, tragically, that's how the Bible lays it out. There will be 5 months of torment. It's referred to in Revelation chapter 9.
Now, and you contend the end of the world, October 21st, 2011.
Yes. It's, God has laid these things out. I would recommend people visiting familyradio.com to find out more detailed information, but that's the way it's going to work. May 21 will be the day God comes for his people, and one big event on that day will be a worldwide earthquake. And we're
beyond what we just had in Japan?
Well, yes. I mean, that was a horrible earthquake, and all the damage that it's done is terrible. But the Bible speaks of a great earthquake that the world has never seen before, and it will be worldwide. It will not be limited to one country.
All right. We're going to continue monitoring this with you, Chris. I got to ask you one question about Family Radio, because and I don't want to put you on the spot, but they sent me a donation form, and I could elect to take monthly payments and send them to them. Why monthly payments if it's all over?
Well, I don't know, George. those forums have been in use probably for many years, and with such a pressing urgency to get the gospel to the whole world, I'm sure that was just an oversight.
All right. That's Chris McCann. We're going to keep looking in on what he has to report. May 21st, they say, Judgment Day, end of the world, October 21st, 2011. Two Japanese automakers are scaling back production at North American plants as they assess their ability to get parts from Japan after the country's devastating earthquake and tsunami. Subaru of America has suspended overtime at its only North American plant in Lafayette, Indiana. Toyota is suspending overtime and Saturday production at its 10 plants in the region. The Federal Reserve says the U.S. recovery is gaining traction and inflation pressure from soaring energy costs should be short-lived, allowing it to maintain its heavy support for the economy. Now, in a moment, we'll be talking with Chris Catcher about the economy, about the relationship with Japan. You know, they are our second largest debt holder right under China. What does that mean if they go under? And we'll also talk about this radiation situation. He is a physicist as well. Our feature story at coasttocoastam.com, doctors in China are battling to save a baby born with his heart growing outside of his body. The little two-month-old has only a thin membrane covering his heart, which can be clearly seen beating outside his stomach. We've got that story at coasttocoastam.com. They're going to wait a few more months. Hopefully he'll get a little stronger and then try to do some kind of surgery there. In Libya, Muammar Gaddafi's forces overwhelmed rebels in a strategic eastern city, hammering them with airstrikes, missiles, tanks, and artillery in an assault that sent residents fleeing and they're screaming for people in the West to come and assassinate Muammar Gaddafi. And also Bahrain's king has declared a three-month state of emergency there to quell a Shiite uprising. Saudi Arabia sent Bahrain 1,000 Saudi-led troops to try to quell things there. Jerry Corsi, of course, he's our expert when it comes to these kinds of affairs. Jerry, Gaddafi's still holding on, and with this horrible situation in Japan, it is as if all the attention has left that region.
That's right, George. It's gone off the front page, but while it's not been on the U.S. news, Gaddafi is moving strongly to quash this rebellion. In about another week, I think he'll be secure. I don't think the world powers are going to get it together to establish a no-fly zone. Usually for NATO to act, the United States has to be very involved, and the White House has not taken a strong position on military action in Libya. So absent any blockage, I think Gaddafi's military will crush the rebellion, and it will not take very long.
Yeah, I thought by now that the Gaddafi would be tossed out without any help from the outside. I think you're absolutely right, Jerry. He's going to stay in power.
And I think that what's going on in Bahrain will mean, again, that the democracy forces there, the Shiites, will be crushed. I don't think there's going to be any change in Bahrain with basically an invasion going on from Saudi Arabia. So you've got two situations developing in the Middle East which are going to, you know, especially with Gaddafi, allow a known dictator, a enemy of the United States, really a dangerous, probably madman, to stay in power by his own military force. And it'll be a real tragedy to the region if Gaddafi stays in power.
Jerry Corsi, of course, writes for WorldNet Daily. He's a noted author. And, of course, his newsletter, free newsletter, by the way, is called Red Alert, which you can get more information at WorldNet Daily. In a moment, we're going to get you an update on the situation with nuclear power, the financial markets. What does it all mean to you? Chris Catcher, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Chris Catcher received his Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry and PhD in nuclear physics from the University of California at Berkeley, where he studied under Nobel laureate Professor Glenn Seaborg and helped to discover element 110 on the periodic table of elements and confirm element 106. He's also the founder of selfishinvesting.com, managing director and chief investment strategist for Mocha Investors as well. And his investment career began in 1995 when he founded one of the first internet-based stock advisory services. Here's Chris Catcher back on Coast to Coast AM. What a mess we're in, Chris.
Indeed so, George. By the way, thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. Okay, so Japan, second largest debt holder, right under China. They're having a horrendous time. Their central bank just pumped $45 billion into their struggling economy, added by this earthquake and tsunami. What does it mean to us, Chris? Will Japan ever get to the point and say, hey, we need this $800 billion or whatever they've invested here. We need our cash.
Well, it's certainly going to prompt Ben Bernanke to continue the quantitative easing program that he began in March of 2009. I mean, there's been debate as to whether QE2, as it's called, is going to end this coming June 30th. But now with what has happened in Japan, I think that pretty much seals the deal that we're going to extend QE into a QE3 situation, which means that the dollar is probably going to continue to devalue and the price of real assets such as commodities and stocks as well will probably continue to rise.
Geez, not good. Not good at all. Chris, let's talk a little bit about nuclear power for a moment. The whole world is looking at this tragedy in Japan and how it could affect us here on the West Coast of the United States and in other regions as well, too. It's obvious. It's not as safe as they led us to believe.
Well, you know, I'm of two minds on this. Now, first of all, I'm in agreement that governments do cover up and governments manipulate, and it's the manipulation done at the expense of citizens that live under that government.
Yeah.
And I believe this happens all over the world. I mean, the United States is particularly pernicious when it comes to this. However, when it comes to nuclear safety and nuclear crisis situations like the one we're in right now, the one that Japan is dealing with, Over history, there has been great media distortions in terms of what is really happening and in terms of the long-term effects of the radiation. Now, when it comes to the situation in Japan, from my understanding up to this point, the situation is not as bad as the media is letting on. Now, of course, it is a tragedy, and any life lost or anyone who gets cancer as a result of this is tragic in and of itself. But in terms of the absolute numbers of the collateral damage done to human life, it's essentially a lot better, or rosier, I should say, than the sky is falling mentality that the media does tend to paint. And I've just been scanning the web here for real-time updates, and 9 out of 10 articles are paint a very negative picture about what's going on in Japan. On occasion, I do see, for instance, a voice of reason, such as Donald Olander. He's a professor emeritus of nuclear engineering at my alma mater, the UC Berkeley. And he was saying that he believes Japanese government officials are being rightly cautious in this situation. They don't want to stir panic, but they are being properly cautious. And he did say that the heavily elevated levels of radiation around the nuclear plant, while harmful to health, as these levels did spike due to the fire and the explosion, are unlikely a long-term health hazard, because these levels will drop. And Japan's Idano did say that the white smoke that is being seen at the moment is likely non-radioactive vapor, and that the radiation, by my count here, the radiation fell at 10:54 a.m., that's Japan time, which is just a few hours ago, so that there was no need to widen the evacuation area.
Well, you know, today the workers fled the plant for their own safety. You, of course, you're aware of the old story from John Fuller about we almost lost Detroit when the Fermi plant almost had a problem. We've had a three mile island disaster in Pennsylvania, Chernobyl. I'm not saying nuclear power is bad, Chris. I just don't know if they've designed these plants the right way.
Well, in terms of the, let's take Three Mile Island, for instance. I'd like to say, just before I preempt that, with the saying there's nothing to fear but fear itself, does hold true in the case of Three Mile Island, what they call a disaster. I remember growing up and hearing all kinds of accounts of it. But as I studied what really happened in Three Mile Island, there was no collateral damage. The radioactive material was contained within its containment vessel with no harm to anybody. So there was no radiation leak because the thick concrete armor around the reactor did hold. And so I found that the media greatly exaggerated the effects of Three Mile Island. Now, Chernobyl reactor, on the other hand, they had no shell and was also operation. They had a number of chain reaction problems when the disaster struck. So they had a far greater problem and released a substantial amount of radioactivity into the atmosphere. Now, I just wanted to put the situation, what's going on in Japan, in perspective. The average amount of radiation, if you go back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the average amount that victims were exposed to in the increased risk of, say, dying from lung cancer. Now, I'm not talking about the people who were at ground zero, but I'm talking about the survivors and the years that ensued after the bombings. The survivors' incident of lung cancer increased by about 40%. Now, that can be compared to, say, someone who smokes a pack of cigarettes a day. They're increasing their risk of dying of lung cancer by about 400%, or 10 to 1. And as it turns out, radiation is actually a weaker carcinogen compared to other carcinogens, such as phenols, nitrites, basic preservatives, a lot of the chemicals that we are surrounded by that are belched out by, say, coal plants, fossil fuels, are far on balance greater damage, cause greater collateral damage to human beings. But unfortunately, the fear of radiation is the strongest. And as soon as we hear the words nuclear contamination, our brains go on red alert. We think of mushroom clouds, radiation burn victims, and cancer. And basically, to encapsulate what I'm saying, the worst commercial disaster in history was Chernobyl. And that Chernobyl was nowhere near Hiroshima and Nagasaki, of course. And Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant situation is less than that of Chernobyl.
Let's talk more about that, Chris, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, child brain scans pick out future criminals. We're going to talk with Neil Slate about that and other issues relating to the brain next hour on Coast to Coast AM. His latest work, Secret of the Dormant Brain Lab. So get ready for that. When we come back with Chris Hatcher, we're going to continue to get his take on the meltdown in Japan and nuclear power. Chris Hatcher has been our special guest before, and he's our guest right now on Coast to Coast AM. Chris, yesterday we had a guest who said that he thinks the future should be smaller nuclear plants, not big ones, but that spread them all out all over the place. What do you think of that?
You know, it's interesting that a colleague of mine, Albert Chiorso, he led the 110 experiment. And he actually had designs on how to make portable particle accelerators. So you wouldn't need these huge cyclotrons. And in theory, you could extend his reasoning to much smaller nuclear power plants, which he argued would be much safer. And there are some interesting designs out there that are revolutionary in terms of safety measures. And the question was asked, why is this? Aren't these designs being implemented? And I think the simple reason is that the nuclear power industry is incredibly regulated, the most regulated industry. It's full of bureaucracy, mm-hmm. and bureaucracy doesn't really have much patience for creative, clever ideas.
We have about, 104 online nuclear plants now in this country?
Something like that.
Yeah, and a lot of them are old, outdated. Should they do a pretty thorough job of just, you know, updating them, remodeling them, can they?
I believe that there are programs already in place that are going to be replacing certain components in these reactors that are located in the U.S. And I think there's 440 commercial nuclear power plants operating in 30 countries around the world. And that means 14% of the world's energy comes from nuclear power. The U.S. gets 20%. Of its power from nuclear reactors, and Japan gets 30%. And China, interestingly, plans to quadruple its nuclear capacity by the year 2020.
What would you recommend to people who are running around trying to get these potassium iodide pills?
I think it's a very very typical human behavior. When you have a crisis situation that is stoked by the media, you have this kind of reaction where it's a better safe than sorry reaction, kind of like after 9/11, you had people who wouldn't fly commercial planes out of concern that they were going to get shot down or hijacked. I think the fear is misplaced. It's totally understandable from a psychological standpoint why people would react this way. So I'm not saying it's wrong, but I do think it's overblown. And the idea, of course, behind the iodine pellets is if you saturate yourself with iodine, then radioactive iodine cannot enter your system, or is much less likely to contaminate you.
Coal versus nuclear power, which way?
Well, I have quite a few things to say about that. When we would talk about this, and Glenn Seaborg, the nuclear science group, was one of the most prestigious groups at UC Berkeley. Essentially, nuclear power is far cleaner than coal-burning plants. Coal causes all sorts of health problems to those within miles of the plant, as its pollution is thick and far-reaching. But these health problems occur over a period of many years rather than the sudden instantaneous horror of a full-scale nuclear plant meltdown. The media often brings images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki into the public conscious to further blast a technology that is, on balance, far safer than coal. Then you've got, of course, popular shows like The Simpsons with evil Mr. Burns running his nuclear power plant, the three-eyed fish that swim nearby, and Homer's low sperm count. Incidentally, out of all the hours, there's some 14,000 cumulative reactor years, I should say years, of commercial operation in 32 countries. And in that long extended period, there have been only two major accidents, now three with Fukushima.
Right.
So that's pretty good, you know, in terms of the track record there. Coal, on the other hand, is the silent killer. You don't have these huge, horrific situations that rise out of nothing, but you have this silent killer. Coal generates all sorts of waste product, resulting in acid rain and greenhouse gas emissions, disturbs the air quality. People who are living near coal plants may ingest the fly ash, and actually fly ash has more radiation in it, actually up to 10 times the amount of thorium and uranium than anything that comes out of a nuclear power plant, because the nuclear power plants are much cleaner in terms of their waste generation.
Chris, you're an investment advisor. What would you be recommending to people right now about investing if they want to invest in alternative energy or energy at all?
Well, I would say because of the QE, the quantitative easing that's in effect, the best way is to invest in hard assets. This would be precious metals, commodities, even stocks, as they should continue their rise, of course, with the occasional correction. And it's due not just to QE, but you have commodity supply shortages going around the world. You have demand exerted from emerging creditor countries such as China and India. And such countries should continue to increase their, for instance, the gold and silver reserves, since they assume that debtor nations like the U.S. and the U.K. and Europe will continue to devalue their currencies. And there's a parallel here in terms of Japan's fiscal policies and what's going on in the U.S. Now, everyone is talking about the current crisis in Japan. I've studied crisis situations going back decades, and they're generally short-lived. The markets generally bounce back fairly quickly. Now, the long-term impact of the crisis going on in Japan and the rest of the world will most likely be benign, if history is any guide. But what won't be benign, but rather malignant, is the government policy that's been going on. I mean, if you look at Japan's government policy, they encouraged bad loans in the 80s with no regard for the quality of the borrower, mm-hmm. which helped to inflate the bubble in Japan to grotesque proportions. And so after their bubble burst in 1990, the government there tried a series of economic stimulus programs and bank bailouts, throwing good money after bad. I mean, it sounds pretty familiar, kind of what's been going on in this country now. So Japan's 2.4 budget surplus that they had in 91 turned into a deficit of 10% by 1998, and today their national debt to GDP ratio stands at a whopping 249%.
Well, that's a lot. So let me ask you first of all about the radiation out there. Are you saying at least on the West Coast here, the United States, we've got nothing to worry about? Are you saying we should be cautious? What are you saying there?
I would say the odds are extremely low that anyone on the West Coast is in harm's way. Extremely low. I mean, of course, like as all matters in life, nothing is guaranteed. But then if you drive a car on the freeway, you actually hear odds of having an accident and being put in the hospital are fairly substantial. And most people don't think of it in those terms. So, I mean, if you put it in terms of an odds perspective, I think there's a lot more that one should be concerned with than having radiation effects from the crisis in Japan.
And you're saying continue to build nuke power plants?
I'm sorry?
Continue to build new plants?
Oh, absolutely. The world, it's a clean source of energy. Unfortunately, as much as I love wind power and solar power, they're not economically viable as of yet. I'm certainly looking forward to the day where they become economically viable. But in the meantime, I believe that nuclear power is a far safer alternative to fossil fuels and coal plants.
All right, let's wrap up the hour here. Chris, we'll take phone calls. Jennifer is in Rochester, Minnesota. First-time caller. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I just wanted to call because I heard about the end of the world thing. I'm a Christian, and I had been reading the Bible, and it states that we don't know the day or the hour. Not even the angels know. And it also is written that the Bible also states that the reason why Jesus hasn't come yet for the second time, he wants to make sure everybody is repented.
Well, I'm going to make a little side bet here with everybody, Jennifer. I don't think the judgment day will be on May 21st, and I don't think the end of the world will happen on October 21st.
I agree, because I feel like when everybody makes these predictions, what if they're wrong? Because if they're wrong, we'll laugh at them. But if they are right and we go up to heaven or wherever we are, end up, they can't say anything because they're dead.
That's right. Thanks. Let's go to West of the Rockies. Patricia in San Francisco. Go ahead, Patricia.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have some questions about this process that goes on in the nuclear reactors.
Sure, go ahead.
I'd like to understand. There's two questions. Why do the fuel rods, when they're spent, continue to retain heat? And also, when the reactor was shut down, the control rods stopping the neutron migration and shutting off the nuclear reaction, why does the core retain heat? And what would the temperature rise to if it was not cooled at all?
Well, Chris, do you know anything about fuel rods?
Well, you know, this is I'm a nuclear physicist, not a nuclear engineer. However, I had friends in that field, and I can give it my best shot here, even though I'm not an engineer per se. I would say that the fuel rods, well, they retain heat because you have, first of all, they're fuel, they're radioactive fuel. They have radioactivity going on, therefore they're going to retain heat. If you have close to critical mass, that's going to generate a lot of heat. So you need to handle those with great care. And so, you know, same reason why the core does retain heat, and therefore you have to be managing these sorts of things with all kinds of state safety precautions. The Chernobyl disaster was a sudden spike in the neutron multiplication rate that caused the core to increase in temperature to unsafe levels. And this caused the water coolant to flash to steam. That caused a sudden overpressure within the pressure vessel. And so the whole threat to public safety was the dispersed core gases that result, which were highly radioactive. And actually, I'd also like to point out that in Chernobyl's case, the accident had dire off-site effects, but much of the radioactivity remained within the building. And to prevent something like this from reoccurring, they created all sorts of steps like adding neutron poisons to key parts of the reactor. And modern reactors, of course, make a full-blown meltdown quite unlikely because they have the material inside the reactor's containment structure. So even if there is a meltdown that damages the reactor itself, that potentially contaminates the whole structure, the meltdown alone should not lead to a significant radiation release or a serious danger to the public.
And do we know how hot they get? I think the meltdown occurs at 2,800 degrees Celsius.
It's quite high. That sounds in the ballpark. Specifically, an engineer could give you the exact figure. It sounds about right to me from what I understand.
Okay. Next up, let's go to DJ in Jeffersonville, Indiana. Hey, DJ, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Real quick here. I know this guy's pro-nuclear because, you know, I've been listening to the show. I don't know of any solar panels that have killed anybody that, you know, that have broke or wind generators unless they actually got caught in the propeller one. But my question to your guest is, what would you suggest we do with all this nuclear waste that we have here in the United States? I was wondering if maybe we could take it and bring it to your backyard.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it's interesting because we talked about how to do, you know, the bioremediation, how to deal with all this nuclear waste that's built up. And I got to say, a good analogy is that since...
Well, you still there? Well, we're going to have to call him back, Tommy. We'll get you back, Chris, right away. Always during a controversial issue, they disappear on us. So we'll get him right back on and we'll take your calls. Meanwhile, I'll go to Corvallis, Oregon. Brent's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Brent, go ahead. You're on with me.
Yes, George. I just wanted to point out that Chris is one of the more refreshing
Well, it's important for us to bring back different views, and you know whether you agree or not, you got to hear a different perspective. Yeah. That's the only way we learn.
Well, I'm a nuclear engineer with 30 years worth of experience working on one of those smaller nuclear reactor designs, and the next generation of reactors is has many more safety features than any of these 40-year-old Japanese reactors on it, and Chris is just, you know, right on with all of his information. I've never heard anybody be able to pull that many sources together and talk intelligently on the whole matter. It would be really interesting to see or hear Chris and one of
the other side.
The other side at the same time.
Maybe a little debate?
Yeah, a little debate. And then I would also suggest that if you want to know what to do with the spent fuel, instead of throwing it away, we should be reprocessing it and dealing with a much smaller...
What could you do with it if you reprocess it?
Well, what you'll find out, and Chris can verify this, is that during the normal fuel cycle, you only burn about 1 or 2% of the available uranium-235 or plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the fuel, and then it builds up a waste product, which keeps the chain reaction from going. What you would do is remove the byproducts and then feed the viable material back into the next set of fuel assemblies.
All right, so, Chris, you're back with us. Let's get your reaction to all of this.
Yeah, I wanted to address the gentleman's first question about what to do with all the waste. And certainly there's been a huge buildup because since 1945 and even before then, there was so much waste generated and there were not proper measures taken to as to what to deal with it. We put it in landfills. Technology needs to find a way to deal with all of this. Of course, the Nobel Prize would go to the person who figures out a way to increase the half-life of this radioactive waste, or a way to separate it out again so it could be reused. Now, he mentioned something about solar panels and wind generation devices. Yes, of course, there's no casualties when it comes to those sorts of things. But I would point out that life is fraught with casualties in the most unexpected places. I mean, food coloring, the types of preservatives they put in our food, the smog, air quality, all have very long-term dramatic effects on the human body, but we're not fearful of things like that as much because it's a long, steady process of deterioration to the human body. The problem really comes down to it's an odds. There's a table of odds of getting various cancers, various maladies based on what you eat, where you live. For instance, people who live in very high altitudes are getting a much higher dose of radiation than those who live at sea level. And so then that could play into people who have a higher incidence of, for instance, skin cancer.
So what you're basically saying, though, Chris, is that the risks far outweigh, the rewards far outweigh the risk.
Absolutely. And you have a media that paints a horrible picture because it sells a lot of papers, gets a lot of attention, but it's not necessarily reporting of the facts and the long-term consequences of nuclear power. So what needs to be done is a cost-benefit analysis, just like with everything, to see how much benefit we really are getting from nuclear power versus the cost. The cost in terms of not just economic cost, but in terms of the cost of health, human health, and human life. And I think that if people run these studies and actually look at the facts, they'll be very impressed with the nuclear power track record versus the fossil fuel track record.
Okay, very good. Chris, thank you so much. Chris's websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We will continue to monitor this story for as long as we have to, bringing you the latest news and information with guests that you may or may not agree with, but at least a perspective that's important for you to understand. As far as the radiation from Japan and will it hit the United States, we will monitor that too in the event that the government doesn't tell us. I'll be back in a moment with Neil Slade as we talk about the brain on Coast to Coast AM.